welcome back to Daphne 2 Presents. Thank you so much for joining me. Today I have author M.D. Payne. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, Matt?
Sure. So I write children's books, both fiction and nonfiction, for middle grade audiences. So that's like 8 to 12-year-olds. And I've contributed to the New York Times best-selling Who Was series, including the What is the Story of Scooby-Doo title.
And that's what got me in touch with you. I was like, how obscure of Scooby media can I find people from? And I'm like, you know what? This guy seems really cool. I'm going to hit him up.
That's awesome. Yeah, you know, and it's fun to be part of that universe because I certainly got sucked into it and having to look at everything from, you know, how Scooby was created all the way up to what they're planning to do next. And you know, I actually, when I first started, I was working with Warner Brothers, who own the copyright now, who own Scooby-Doo, and they sent on this massive, like, 250-page style guide. Like, this is what Scooby should look like. This is not what Scooby should look like. Here's, you know, like, the different styles you can use, both for, like, the characters, but also, like, fonts and different books. And so talk about getting granular.
Oh, man, you got the full experience. So are you a Scooby-Doo fan?
You know, it's funny. Scooby-Doo was always part of my life, though I was more into, you know, sort of space opera type stuff when I was a kid, right? Like Star Trek, Star Wars, and all the spinoffs of Star Trek. But I knew Scooby, and it's funny how, like, you know, the theme song would pop into my head as an adult, you know, oftentimes without any rhyme or reason, right? It was such an ingrained part of my childhood.
It's just in you, yeah.
Just in me, yeah.
So do you have a favorite Scooby-Doo movie or episode?
I mean, for me, the first two series were the first two seasons, rather, the original, right?
Like the original Where Are Ya?
Yeah, like that's where the magic happens for me, and like all the kind of like pop culture references that have come with it. Like, yeah, I would have gotten away with it too if it weren't for you meddling kids. And you know, like Velma dropping her glasses and she can't see, and you know, like everybody's role. And you know, I actually, one of the episodes that I researched very deeply for the book was the very first episode, just because of like, the sort of seminal moment that was. And I would have loved to be around to like be in front of, you know, a TV when that first, you know, A Night for a Night came out, and nobody knew who Scooby was. Like nobody knew anything about it. And then there was this weird Saturday morning cartoon that showed up with like a dog and a laugh track and like ghosts and mystery. And it was just, you know, for me, that's like, I wish I could have been there to see Scooby in real time, right? Because now we know Scooby from everything that's happened, even up to the latest project with Mindy Kaling that's going to be happening soon, right?
Ooh, but tomorrow, it's as of recording this, tomorrow it's coming out.
Oh, that's awesome. I didn't even know when, but I knew it was soon. It's exciting. I was actually just talking with my barber about it, of all people. I just got a haircut. Is this going to be video or just audio?
Both, yeah.
Oh, good. So I look at this fresh haircut.
And oh, sure, yeah.
unprompted, he brought up a Scooby-Doo reference.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was at a concert recently, and I guess apparently the band, the small venue in Teaneck, of all places. Teaneck,
okay. Yeah.
It's a local band from Rutherford, where I live, called C-Chain. No, wait, now I'm going to get it wrong. C plus, but okay. It's spelled S-E-A, like, or no, S-E-E plus, C plus.
Okay.
They did a cover of the Scooby-Doo theme song. And the crowd, which was filled with a bunch of Gen Z like people, which just like went wild. I'm like, it's like every age, right? Like you have Gen Z that still loves Scooby-Doo.
That's the thing about Scooby, is you can't avoid the references. No matter where you go, what you watch, it's everywhere.
It's that theme, right? Like just sticks in your head. And you know, similar things happened to me while I was in the midst of the book, which the book came out, I want to say, in 2017 or early 2018. I finished it in 2017. So, like, I'm familiar with the world of Scooby-Doo up until that point. So the last 5 years I'm a little foggy on. But, like, that's what I deeply researched was, you know, from 69 to 17. And I was on the train commuting into New York, and a guy that I would chat with occasionally, his name's Nirav, and he's from India.
Okay.
And he's like, what are you working on? And I said, oh, I'm working on What Is the Story of Scooby-Doo? And he's like, oh my God, that's amazing. And I used to watch every Scooby-Doo episode. I'm like, in India? In that, mm-hmm. like, he's like, yeah, it was huge in India.
Yeah, I was surprised to find out how huge it is there. My goodness.
Yeah. He's everywhere. He's everywhere.
Every country has their own dub. Everyone's like, I was very surprised to find out how many languages there are. And even from your book, you mentioned one of the voice actors internationally for Scooby-Doo is like the longest running voice actor of all time or something like that. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I think the guy from Brazil has done the Scooby-Doo voice in Brazilian, or like the Brazilian version of it, for the longest period. I think it was something like 35 plus years.
Wow.
Some insane amount.
Oh man. Yeah, the Scooby-Doo is so popular in Brazil. I was very surprised to find that out too. I'm half Indian and half Brazilian, so the Scooby-Doo all comes from there.
So now that's how you have the both perspective. That's funny.
So you started out with What a Night for a Night, right? What did you, was there any surprising things you found out just from that first episode?
I think, you know, but for me, it was everything that led up to that, and just the story of how television gets made, especially in an era when television was king, like the late 60s. So the idea that, you know, Fred Silverman, who was the executive at CBS, that was like, we need more wholesome Saturday morning programming for kids. It needs to be a cartoon. And then he worked with, this is 5 years ago. I need to get the names right. Hold on, Joe, you know better than me, the creators. Hold on. The two guys who would go on.
Hanna-Barbera, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Hanna-Barbera, when he went to them, they had initially an idea of like a dog who would be called Too Much. So okay. Just that alone, the idea that like, Scooby-Doo was not Scooby-Doo at some point.
Right.
And that it was a little bit different, and they were like a roving band of musicians that would solve mysteries, and Scooby would play the bongos, you know, which I'm sure, I mean, you know better than me. Was there an episode he ever did play a bongo in? Probably.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we've seen him play at some point. And I've always had the theory the gang is a traveling band. I'm like, how do they make their money?
Well, that's deep down inside what they were, right?
Right. And now it makes so much more sense.
And yeah, just the idea that like too, you know, would too much be on our lips as much as something like Scooby-Doo? It's so fun to say. It's so silly. And he's so Scooby-Doo. I mean, he's
right.
Scooby-Doo. And how that came to be, where it was literally Fred Silverman, the executive, being like, I like everything, but the dog should be... Scooby-Doo, yeah, Scooby-Dooby-Doo, yeah, like that Sinatra song, right? That's good. I don't know if that's how Fred Silverman talks, but
I love it.
Why not? You just picture the meeting and it just like that one moment.
Mm-hmm. It was
all about the name, right? I mean, geez. You know, I didn't know. So for me, it was that evolution of what Scooby could have been and then what Scooby became. And then 50 years later, it's like, wow, what a phenomenon. I mean, more than 50 years now.
Was the book at all part of the 50-year celebration, do you know? Because that was about, I think 2019 was 50 years.
Yeah, it was not, but I was grateful that it happened shortly thereafter. Just because, you know, there was a lot more attention on Scooby, although, as we've said, right, like Scooby's already... sort of in the psyche and in the pop culture of many, many people in many countries. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I was a little surprised that Warner Brothers didn't do more for the 50th anniversary. Like,
mostly about the merchandise. There was just boatloads of Scooby-Doo merchandise everywhere.
So, I was glad to be part of that out there in the world. You know, we had a nice enough relationship with Warner Brothers that when we asked them to put something out on the official Scooby-Doo Facebook page, they did. Mm-hmm. So when the book was released, they put something special up on the main Scooby-Doo Facebook page. And it was like 99% like, this is great. I can't wait to get it. And then there was like that 1% group that was like, Why does his head look like that? Scooby's supposed to look like? This is terrible. Actually, let me grab, for those who don't know the cover, let me grab the cover real quick. Because the Who Was series is known for its little bobbleheads, right? Oh, yeah. Like, so there's R.L. Stine from Goosebumps. There's Duke Ellington. There's Captain Kirk. He was the other pop culture icon that I wrote about. And there's Scooby.
Yeah.
And what's exciting is my name's on the gravestone, which is such an honor, right?
It took me forever to realize. I'm like, where is the author's name on this? I'm like, wait.
He's dead.
It's right there.
So, like, there was a small contingent of people who were like, I'll never buy that book because that's not what Scooby's supposed to look like. And I'm like, oh, sorry. didn't know.
Little do they know, the illustrations inside are so beautiful and unique. Like, I gotta ask, is every drawing in there original for the book?
It is all original for the book, yes.
Wow. It's,
and what's funny is like
the best Scooby art I've ever seen, to be honest.
Awesome. Yeah, I had a little bit of say in the art. Well, not say in it so much as if they needed to fact check something that would become art. Mm-hmm. So I got a call from my editor that was like, where was Silverman's office? Was he in New York or was he in LA? And I'm like, oh, looking through my notes, right? And I'm like, oh God, he had offices in both locations, but I think he worked primarily out of LA. And like that kind of, I'm like, why are you asking? She's like, because when we talk about him, you know, coming up with the name Scooby-Doo, we want to like show the CVS offices, you know? So that kind of granular research was going on.
It was cool, like pictures of Scooby-Doo stuff you never thought you would see. Definitely like the monster truck and the race car, that was so much fun to see in there. How do you decide what's important to include in these historical books targeted at children?
It's hard because, you know, nonfiction in general, you're doing so much research. Mm-hmm. When you're doing nonfiction for children, you're doing just as much research. Mm-hmm. And then squeezing it down even more because of your audience. And so there is a lot of like, what is interesting, right? Like,
right.
I have a very limited amount of space to tell the Scooby-Doo story to people who have, frankly, a very limited attention span. Mm-hmm. And the Who Was series is known for being able to like captivate its readers. So, I mean, it was just like refinement after refinement after refinement. And I think a lot of it was just less of like, I want to be able to get some of the technical jargon in there because obviously Scooby-Doo, you know, outside of the canon of Scooby-Doo, which is a little easier to write about. Like, let me tell the story of Scooby-Doo and everything he's gone through from when he premiered in 1969 all the way till today. Mm-hmm. It was more of like what was happening in the real world around that I wanted to structure around it, you know, in a way that was interesting for young readers. And which is why, you know, cool kind of lore-like stories like Silverman coming up with the name is so much more interesting than like, you know, a lot of raw statistics on animation. And we went into it a little bit about like what animation was like then and what it's like now and the difference between hand drawing every cell. And so, but that's, you know, kind of interesting too. So it was just having written only fiction before Scooby-Doo.
Really?
Yeah, so I had written six books for Penguin from a series called Monster Juice that I created. So it was all kind of like Goosebumps, Gross Out, kind of like crazy, you know, kids saving the day.
Are you still doing Monster Juice?
So Monster Juice is done, but I'm working now on another children's horror fiction. It working title right now is Get Pumped, and it's about controlling pumpkins that try to take over a town. So like.
That sounds very Scooby-Doo.
Exactly. Instead of the mask, you take off the pumpkin. So, you know, nonfiction is such a different beast. And to this day, I will never forget, I turned in my second draft from the balcony of the hotel I was staying at in Disney World. The first time that I brought my first child, Molly, with my parents. They were like, when she turns 5, we're going to take her to Disney. I'm like, that's awesome. Little did I know I'd have a crash deadline of Scooby-Doo. And I had turned in my original draft and had a whole bunch of notes where it was like, we want to know more about X, Y, and Z. And so even though I had done my research, I had to do even more research.
Of course.
And there were things that Warner Brothers didn't even know.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so
wow.
So I'm listening to like podcasts that are like, talk about the obscure, right? Like, with Joe Barbera and I'm forgetting the names, which is terrible.
William Hanna.
Well, thank you, William Hanna and Joe Barbera, and you know, talking about the original days of Scooby-Doo and their memories of it, and like, you know, stuff that the people who own the copyright don't really know about. They just know that they own this property now.
They don't know all the dirty deeds behind it.
Yeah. And what's true and what's not. I mean, right. This is kind of veering a little bit, but when I wrote the Duke Ellington, like who was Duke Ellington?
Mm-hmm.
Ellington was so good at presenting a persona that was actually not reality, to the point where he had married one woman and then kind of like shipped her off to Washington, D.C., took the kid they had together, but then a series of mistresses he was with helped take his, you know, take care of his child. But of course, that wasn't becoming of someone who's trying to be in high society. So at the time, like when the Times was asking about all these women he was with, I was like, well, that's my second wife and that's my third wife. And like, but he never legally married them. But someone like the New York Times has it on record that Duke Ellington, you know, this is his third wife or whatever. And like, so A, how bizarre that that stuff gets like dredged up, but B, kids don't care anyway, you know what I mean? Like that's the kind of thing where I'm like going deep into the weeds on Duke Ellington and I'm like, oh God.
Gotta pull back a second.
Gotta pull back, hold on a minute, not relevant for the audience. And then she helped take care of his child, you know, just very simple language.
Right. So you mentioned you listened to some podcasts as research. I think that's really interesting. Do you remember which ones you listened to? There's a lot of iconic Scooby-Doo podcasts out there.
Goodness, it wasn't a Scooby-Doo podcast. Okay. It was a podcast about like Hollywood stories.
Okay.
And they talked to, this is crazy, I'm referencing my own book. But you know, I've since written a few more and it's hard to absorb everything and I'm a father of two kids. And so I was looking for some first, you know, some information on those early days and specifically with, hold on a minute, Joe Ruby and Ken Spears, who were actually the people who brought Scooby-Doo to life and presented it to Fred Silverman. Mm-hmm. And I found a interview with Joe Ruby that was late aughts, where I was talking to him literally about like how did Scooby-Doo come to be and what were you and, you know, Ken Spears hoping to achieve and how did you present, you know, approach Fred Silverman. And it was a Hollywood podcast, which I don't remember the name of the podcast, but it was a sort of like behind the scenes, like interviewing folks who were like big in the 50s and 60s about their memories of like Hollywood and television and what was happening back in the day. Of course, I'm not going to find it. But yeah, wasn't a Scooby-Doo specific podcast. I will dig that up and find it for you, I promise.
Thank you. So what else? Tell me more about the research process and the writing process for this book and your books in general.
Yeah, so part of it was I was able to talk with Warner Brothers, which was great, right? Certainly for canon purposes, right? What they consider Scooby-Doo canon versus not. Research everything, you know, heavily in the beginning, right? Like, but also a comic book came out, like right at the time the first episode aired, there already was a comic book available.
With the pink mystery machine.
yeah. And from a now defunct, you know, comics, it was certainly not Marvel. It was certainly not.
No.
You know, all the merchandise that happened around it, the super fans who like love Scooby and have bought up all the merchandise. You know, looking into how the movie came to be when those first live action slash, you know, animated, when, you know, obviously Scooby was still the cartoon, but, you know, a lot of deep digging into like, and with my editor too, like how much do we go into the fact that like, Scrappy-Doo is like super hated?
You know? Oh yeah. It's a touchy subject. I wasn't sure how you were going to mention it or if I was even going to see him in the book at all. I was happy to see him.
He went very light. It was a light touch.
Very light.
Yeah.
Definitely, it's either love him or hate him. He's definitely got a love resurgence lately, but I think it's just because everybody misses him at this point.
It's funny. Yeah, that's definitely a very touchy subject in the world of Scooby-Doo, for sure. Like, so how do we approach that? You know, learning about like when he was going direct to video, when Warner Brothers first scooped him up, like just sort of all the phases of Scooby's existence, but even just like the fun things about Scooby himself, like how old is Scooby-Doo, right? And, like, again, that was not something that was in the Warner Brothers style guide.
Okay.
But he's 7 years old.
Oh, wow.
His full name is Scoobert.
Yep, Scoobert.
And then all the Doos, right? Mumsy Doo, Dada Doo, Grandpa Scooby, who lives.
Who would have thought Doo was their last name? Definitely as a kid, that took me by surprise. I'm like, wait, there are other Doos?
Yeah. All the Doos. Yabba Dabba Doo, Howdy Doo, Skippy Doo, Ruby Doo. I'm sorry, Yabba Doo, Scooby Dee, Scooby Dum, which of course, and Doobie Doobie Doo, which is almost like that song brought to life.
Right. Some characters we've seen just one time.
Exactly. But if they, even if they talked about them.
Right. I love that you included that whole family tree in there.
You know, the cool stuff about Casey Kasem and the fact that like Shaggy's a vegetarian because of Casey Kasem. Like, for me, that was the most interesting thing. Well, maybe I should rephrase that. That's where I really wanted to keep interest in the kids, right? I knew that the kids were going to gobble up all the stuff about Scooby-Doo because he's Scooby-Doo. But the idea of like, how do I make the world around him, you know, and the people who helped create him and voice him and the other characters interesting. So finding fun stories like that and digging deeper and even just the sort of like, you know, he's like cooking up a veggie burger in the movie, right? They were still kind of like keeping real to his vegetarianism, which I hear has kind of fallen off recently, mainly because
a little bit,
passed away, but.
Yeah, I honestly felt like it was a little bit disrespectful for them to change him from being vegetarian right when
Casey Kasem passed away.
Yeah. Right, they might as well just have kept it. But other Scooby fans have said it was, they don't like that Casey Kasem and, you know, put his views onto the character in the first place. Yeah. But, you know, it's another touchy Scooby-Doo subject that I think he handled very well in the book.
So groundbreaking though, right? The idea that like a cartoon character is a vegetarian, even if like, you know, vocally so.
I feel like the writers made fun of it too at some points. Like, we'll just make him eat a whole eggplant, or like, what do vegetarians eat? They didn't even know.
Then there's all the lore that, again, like the kids aren't interested in, but like I started going down rabbit holes of like the whole comparison of like different colleges in Massachusetts. Is it the Amherst colleges or like the Massachusetts colleges that are like the different characters? And clearly this college is this character. And you know, Shaggy certainly, but do Shaggy and Scooby, do they use marijuana? I don't know. They certainly have the munchies, you know, and like the research that I'm glad you brought that up.
What do you think? Do you think they're stoners?
I mean, I personally do, you know, like the idea that like that, you know, Shaggy's a stoner, right? Like just the image of Shaggy sort of hunched over the tousled hair. He like, hey man, you know, like, but the official line is,
yeah,
everyone says no, absolutely not. But of course, back in the 60s, if you're doing something like where you want to nod to the counterculture but not get in trouble, you're just going to insist that it's not true.
Of course not. And then they stick by that forever. I, you know, I'm maybe the one person in the Scooby community that holds by it. It's Shaggy's a stoner. Yeah,
totally. And Scooby probably is too.
Oh yeah, his Scooby snacks, you know what? You never know what's in them.
Yeah, and also that's the classic, like, it's not what the artist intends but how the audience takes it in. Like, clearly enough of a Scooby-Doo audience that's like, yeah, like you say, even like jokes around Scooby snacks or like, you know, but they played with that a little bit in the movies too, where like there's that scene where it's like smoke coming out of like the mystery machine and it's like
eggplant burgers.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, this is so good, man. Like, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I'm definitely on that road till the end. They're stoners, you know.
So yeah, again, I just noticed I love the shirt, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I thought it was just a cool pattern, and then I looked closer. I'm like, oh, it's Shaggy.
My lighting's not very good in this spot.
The Mystery Machine and
got Scooby. The Mystery Machine and Scooby-Doo all over.
That's awesome.
So how many books have you written?
I have written 12 books, though one book never saw the light of day. It was a project that I did for, I don't know if you ever knew the Cartoon Network show Clarence. You remember that show?
Okay, yeah, yeah, I vaguely remember that airing.
It was 2 seasons, and while they were trying to renew it for a third, they had tapped Penguin, who I work for, to write a book, right? To like a tie-in book, and they were like, we want to have Clarence be a detective. And so I came up with this concept. We'll call it Clarence the Undetectable Detective. And it was really silly and really fun, and I was 2 drafts in, and then my editor was like, let me preface this by saying, we're going to pay you. However, the book, well, they canceled 3, so the Cartoon Network doesn't want to put the book out. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Oh, that's a shocker. I know there's some Clarence fans out there that'll be sad to hear that there was an unreleased book. Oh, man.
It's still there. It could still be, like, I've had visions of, like, at school visits, like, I'm going to read you from a book that's never been published.
Oh, man. Don't get in trouble.
So I've written 12 books. 11 have been published.
Okay.
I'm working on my 13th now, which is the aforementioned Pumpkin Mind Control saga.
Is that through Penguin as well?
Also through Penguin, yeah. All through Penguin Workshop, which is the same company that publishes the Who Was series. So I got sucked into them with Monster Juice after doing some work in Scholastic, where I was like doing creative copy for the Goosebumps series.
Oh, yeah.
And like a website and like a whole bunch of just like...
I want to ask you about that website a little bit. You know, it's such an obscure... like piece of media, you know, you can't access it anymore, obviously, like all
the enterhorrorland.com.
Yeah. Right, what was it called?
Enter Horrorland.
I remember that from my childhood, like what was that, 2008 or something like that?
It was 2007 into 2008. Yep, so it must have launched in 2008.
Yeah, I remember that. It's like you know, it brought back some memories when I saw you worked on that. I'm like, how did you come into like a unique, you know, different type of media project like that? How do you tackle writing for something like that?
I mean, it's kind of bizarre, right? Like not as bizarre as when I had to write like copy that was going to go on a like Taco Bell like toy that was going to kids, which was like write your own book with Slappy the Dummy. Like that was
okay.
How am I going to use this space to create something funny? The website, I was tasked with writing all of the like intros to each of the levels and all of the instructions.
Okay.
If you're tossing like vampire fang darts at you know, balloons, how are you, you know, doing that? And then there's like a barista, and I don't know if you remember the guy who would tell you jokes when you would like pause at the like cafe.
Okay. Yeah, I vaguely remember that.
You know, as much fun as I could have with this very small space and copy that, like, you know, both had to be instructional, right? Because kids needed to know how to play the games or, like, go to where's next. But then also be fun and kind of evocative of the Goosebumps series. So, very different experience. But it kind of kicked me off to where I am now, right? Because then that's how I moved over to Penguin, when the gentleman I worked with on that website became publisher of Grosset and Dunlap at Penguin, and now Penguin Workshop. He's like, yeah, well, have you ever wanted to write your own stuff? You send me some ideas. I'm like, yeah, let's do it.
Oh, man. So that's how you got into Monster Juice then.
Exactly. When I just thought, like, how funny would it be if you were in a retirement home with monsters that were so old, you couldn't even tell they were monsters, right? Like, the vampire's dentures would fall out. The werewolves were, like, muddled fur and, like, on the furniture.
So. What is your favorite book that you've written?
So my favorite book I've written is the second book of the Monster Juice series called Fart. So the Monster Juice series is all about like, what if the grossest things in the world could save it, right? Like, so the first book was Fear the Barfatron, where we find out that barf can kill the evil monster. And the second one is Fart Tsunami. And it's my favorite for 2 reasons. One is because I find farts so much funnier than barf. I mean, to me, barf is actually like, gross. And like the humor of barf is not, I don't really, whereas burps, I think, are just, it's a universal language, right? Like, it's so funny. And so being able to think of how to save the world with a burp, I mean, with a fart, sorry, I'm off track.
That's farts, very middle farts school. And
burps are very fun. Yeah, totally.
It's that perfectly.
Right up their alley. So, I mean, I also like burps as well, but what I meant to say is farts are just universally funny. And it was also the second book I'd written, and the first one was a slog, right? Like, I never intended on being a writer. I was kind of asked, which is a great roundabout way to have it happen.
Okay. But
the first book, I was doubting myself the whole time. Like, should have I said yes? Like, am I a writer? Mm-hmm. And then when I wrote the second book, I'm like, no, I actually am a writer, and this is a lot of fun. And, like, how lucky am I to be able to, like, take horror and farts and meld them together for young kids? Like, how awesome is that?
You wrote what you knew.
Exactly. Write what you know and write what you love. That's the advice I give to young writers.
It's funny. I've heard the second book is the hardest. So it's interesting to hear a different perspective.
Yeah, I think because it was a series and they knew they wanted a number of them. Like, okay. The first one was so character driven and like, mm-hmm. We have to get all these characters right. And the second one was finally like, have fun.
So who have you collaborated with the most in your time with Penguin and working on these book series?
So really my editors. I don't work very closely with the illustrators.
Okay.
They're sort of brought to me by Penguin and then managed by Penguin.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't have a say. I'm not looking at art and saying that looks good, especially for like a series like Who Was, which is a known series and has a huge cadre of illustrators that they work with. They just paired me up with, let's see, the gentleman that worked on the Scooby-Doo book was Andrew Thompson.
Oh, his art is phenomenal.
It's great, yeah, but I never met him and never talked to him.
Okay, you never even talked to him, okay.
No, I did talk to some of the illustrators of Monster Juice.
Okay.
Amanda Dockery was the first, and then a guy named Keith Zhu took over. And I did chat with him a few times, just, you know, about the cover, but also he and I had some ideas for maybe we should, like, do our own thing. We had dinner in the city once, and we're just trying to figure it out, but really it's collaborating with the editors that for me is really helpful, especially for something like What Is the Story of Scooby-Doo, where you're just really trying to nail that formula of how are we getting all the facts in there but keeping kids interested.
So very interesting. I had no idea you didn't work with the illustrators really at all, so interesting to learn.
Yeah, no, and some authors do. Uh-huh. But I do not. Certainly the children's books, the picture books, the author is working very closely with the illustrator.
You're in more of the chapter genre.
Yeah, which is just line art, you know, a little more in the Who Was books, and just a teeny tiny, like, you know, farting little fish as chapter headers and fart tsunami, right? Like just little like angry looking fish that are passing gas, you know, very simple stuff.
Did you influence the character design at all?
I did. Through my editor, who then spoke with the designer.
Okay.
And so the first book, he's like, you know, with Monster Juice, what does Chris look like? Chris is the protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, he looks like me. So, you know, just have some dorky looking blonde kid, you know, you know, with like, you know, some Converse and some, you know, jeans and a blue shirt. Yes, whatever. I get it. There it is.
Nice, nice.
And it's funny because this morning I've been gathering some books up because I'm doing some like author visits, and a librarian had asked for some copies the kids could like read before I got there. So I had gathered a whole bunch of them and they were just sitting on the steps, and my youngest, she's four, mm-hmm. she's looking at like book six of Monster Juice, and she points at the little character and she goes, I know him, but I haven't seen him in this one. And I'm like, just the fact that she knows there's Chris in each of the mm-hmm. covers is kind of like cool.
And, you got the sense of continuity in there.
Yeah. And then for Fart Tsunami, I told them exactly what I wanted on the cover. And okay. They got almost exactly, except they didn't put the smoking vampires on the beach. I wanted some old wrinkled vampires sunning themselves and like slightly smoking on the beach.
So you said you're going to do some visits soon. Can you tell me a little bit about your outreach and work with children?
Yeah. So my thing is, you know, I started on a whim, honestly, in children's book and writing in general, right? And the reason I've stayed here and not tried to like go adult is because there's something very special about connecting with readers who are just starting to read. Mm-hmm. Like, just the idea that you may be their first book is very mm-hmm. exciting, right? And with Monster Juice especially, which is a little more wacky mm-hmm. and out there, and certainly not a known series like the Who Was series, I had parents reach out to me and say, you know, boys and girls alike, you know, I couldn't get them to read squat, and then they opened your book and they just took off.
Oh, wow. That must be a special feeling.
It's really exciting. And, you know, going to schools and visiting with students is important because, you know, writing is such a sort of lonely, you know, just sort of like lots of time and space and stay away from me. I've got to concentrate. It's an antisocial sort of like endeavor. So being able to step into, you know, groups of people who read my books and get reactions and work with them on how they'd like to learn how to become writers. And so, like, I'm doing a series of workshops called What's the Big Idea, where I help kids kind of think through what for me is the hardest part of the writing process, which is mm-hmm. even just coming up with something to write about. And so, yeah, that's kind of, you know, that's really what motivates me to continue, is like connecting with young readers and just seeing their eyes light up when they're like, whoa, this is, so you're an author? That's awesome.
They get to express their imagination. That sounds so joyful. I love it. I love hearing when creators love what they do and love their work. That's so special, you know. That can really make you appreciate a work even more as well, if you know the creator of it loves it.
Yeah, you gotta have fun with it. Otherwise, what am I doing?
Well, thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, of course. This has been such a pleasure. And also to like jumpstart my Scooby brain after having then done the same thing with R.L. Stine, Duke Ellington, and Captain Kirk and Frankenstein. And, you know, so it was an awesome project for sure. So it's nice to be able to go back and think about it.
Are we ever going to see you on another Scooby project, you think?
Maybe. You never know. I mean, at this point, if Penguin does any more licensing with Scooby-Doo, mm-hmm. they'd come to me first, since I'd already literally shed blood, sweat, and tears for Scooby the first go-round. So, yeah, nothing in the works, but never say never. They may even be like, hey, it's been 5 years. Can you update, like, the last few chapters? That would be nice.
Oh, there you go. That'd be fun to see. Where can we find you?
So I am on Instagram as mdpain12, and you can find more about my books on the Penguin Young Readers website.
There you go. Thank you so much for coming on. Have a great day.
Thank you for having me. This was such a pleasure.
We gotta meet up for a cocktail sometime or something.
Yeah, totally. Next time you're around Jersey, let me know.
For sure. I'll be there. All right. Have a great day.
Bye-bye. Thanks for joining Daphne Jew Presents.